Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, what will happen to your socials when you die? We look at how the late South African rapper, AKA's estate, did it.
They wanted to be able to recognize special moments, for example, anniversaries of albums, the day he passed, his birthday, and any other accolades that he may still achieve.
Almost like going to visit his grave and putting flowers on it.
Yes, yes, yes. Those people who really, really were inspired by him and loved his music.
We'll also be hearing what you can do with yours. And in Ghana, a group of journalists and photographers have investigated the ways in which electronic waste is being reused and repurposed.
On the one hand, it provides them badly needed jobs. And on the other hand, the informal way they recycle e-waste exposes them to toxic materials. But over the years, for instance, the Ghana government has promised to construct e-waste recycling facilities to tackle some of these issues. They never did.
It's Monday, the 8th of July. First, we go to the Sahel. Niger, Burkina Faso and Mali have turned their backs on ECOWAS, the regional bloc of West African states. The leader of Niger, General Abdirahman Tiani, made this announcement at the first meeting of a new tripartite alliance of Sahel states. These three pulled out of ECOWAS in January, following military coups and a strengthening of ties with Russia. ECOWAS threatened them with sanctions, expulsion and invasion at the time they seized power. But the generals were impervious to the threats and formed their own club. So we're wondering where this leaves the economic community of West African states to give ECOWAS its full name, because when they pulled out at the beginning of the year, one of the founders of ECOWAS, the former president of Nigeria, Yakubu Gowon, made an impassioned plea in an open letter for them to return.
It saddens me to learn that ECOWAS is threatened with disunity following the announcement by Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger, three important member states, of their intention to leave a community. The impact of such a decision will have far-reaching implications for ordinary citizens who have been the major beneficiaries of regional integration.
That was part of the letter that the former president of Nigeria, Yakubu Gowon, founder member of ECOWAS, wrote at the time that the three countries pulled out of the Economic Community of West African States. Manu Lekunze is a lecturer in international relations at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. So why have the three countries actually come together in this way?
I think the key thing is their common experiences and circumstances. So first is the issues on security in the region have been deteriorating for a very long time. Insurgencies affect all the three countries. And recently, the three countries have a shared experience in that the militaries have taken over from elected governments. So they have the problems that they're all facing, and they have the circumstance in the sense that all of them are military juntas seeking to secure their positions in power.
They've left ECOWAS a while ago, and they announced the formation of this alliance earlier this year. What have we seen them doing together so far?
So one of the key things that they have created this alliance for is deterrence. So they want to be able to speak with one voice and deter any action against them. And I give you a concrete example. When the coup happened in Niger, the Nigerians, through ECOWAS, said they will reverse the coup even if it means using military force. Burkina Faso and Mali came out and say, if you were to send a military to Niger, we will join to fight against ECOWAS with Niger. And that was able to deter the Nigerians from any serious military action in Niger. In terms of practical things that they could do, the different countries are so weak and so poor and so engulfed in different problems that it's difficult for them to mount any serious action together.
They're talking about forming common institutions like banks and infrastructural projects, I imagine. But West Africa does have a bank, and there is a bank that specifically the Francophone countries belong to as well. So how much is that those kind of ideals are piped? Are those just ideals or are they possible?
Yes, they have those ideals. I will use your word and call them ideals, but the practicalities are going to be really, really difficult. One thing you have to understand is that these are landlocked countries in the middle of Africa with very small GDPs, very small international connections. They have mining sectors, but these are relatively small in the grand scheme of things. So trying to create a currency or try to create a bank in the middle of the franc CFA, it's going to be extremely difficult for them. Even if they were to nominally do so, it's very easy for someone else to then challenge that currency or challenge that bank and frustrate their ambitions. So yes, they can talk about these things. They might even wish that they will do it. But even if they do it, the chances of success are really remote.
Do they have other friends in the region? I mean, are there countries that would, you know, give them access to the sea? I'm thinking of Burkina Faso and Ghana, let's say. In other words, I'm still struggling to find whether this is just big talk or are they relying on another strength, friends that they do have in the region or friends further afield? And of course, Russia comes to mind immediately.
So in terms of the region, they do have access for now, like things have been, especially through ECOWAS and other regional institutions, is that countries like Mali have access to the sea through whether it's Guinea or further to Senegal. Niger has traditionally had access to the sea through Benin. But the problem, as you might have seen in the news recently, is that rebels that are opposed to the juntas are attacking their access to the sea. So the oil pipeline that carries oil from Niger through Benin to the sea has been routinely attacked. So they have those problems in the sense that even if they have traditional relations that can get them to the sea, these relationships are vulnerable to counterattack. In terms of externally, you've seen that the US, the UK, France have taken a step back from these particular countries, but Russia has taken a step forward into those countries. And this fits in with a wider Russian strategy, which is really to be present and capable of acting in the borders of NATO, whether you're talking about the eastern border of NATO in Eastern Europe or the southern border of NATO in, say, North Africa and the Sahel. And if you look activity, Russian activities from Sudan all the way to Mali, you can begin to see that there's an emerging strategy here. It's not just opportunism as other people think, but there is an emerging coherence.
So when these countries kicked the French out of their military and economic and political arrangements, they did receive support from their populations. So is Russia now going to offer more than its political game to the populations of these countries? So, for instance, will it offer economic support? Will it offer aid in any way or trade to better the lives of the people in these three countries?
That's a very important question, and it's a question that is not routinely asked and should be asked. So France is still relatively very influential economically in the region. Then you have to think that, can Russia replace France or the European Union? And also remember that France and the European Union are part of the US-led international political economy. So if Russia is out of this international political economy, can it replace France? If you look at the size of the Russian economy and the nature of the Russian trade, you see that, you know, Russia barely has a $2 trillion economy. So my argument is that although Russia is beginning to invest in this region, especially in mining and all of that, it still doesn't have the size, the economic size, as well as the international diplomatic connections to provide an alternative to the French-led political economy in the region.
Now, when this alliance was announced at the beginning of the year, one of the founders of ECOWAS made a very impassioned plea, General Gowon from Nigeria, former president of Nigeria as well, and said, stated the reasons why ECOWAS was formed and almost begged the leaders of these three countries to stay. They've left. I'm wondering, where does that leave ECOWAS now? Is it a sign that ECOWAS's power is waning?
Yes, I agree with you that this is a sign that ECOWAS's power is waning. But you need to take a step back and see that ECOWAS's power has been waning for a very long time. When the architects of ECOWAS, like Gowon that you mentioned earlier, thought about ECOWAS, it was really a regional organization that could advance Nigeria's interest in the region and push France out of the region. However, the French has worked hard to weaken ECOWAS because ECOWAS was going to give more power to Nigeria than the Francophone states, who are the majority of states in West Africa. But France became a supporter of ECOWAS when ECOWAS was already weak, where the French states were able to have significant influence over the ideas of Nigeria. So I give you an example. The ECO was a currency that was created to be the currency of ECOWAS. But if that was going to be the case, then it would have replaced the franc CFA, which the French use as a tool of influence in the region. So you would have been repatriating monetary policy from literally from France or from Europe to Abuja, and that would have empowered the Nigerians more than the French. And the French have actively, you can say, killed the ECO. The plan was for the ECO to go live in 2020. We are in 2024, and there's no ECO. So you can see that this kind of activities had already weakened ECOWAS before the three nations have declared their exit. Their exit is more or less a nail to the coffin of ECOWAS rather than a first step to killing the organization.
Manu Likunze, a lecturer in international relations at the University of Aberdeen. Quick question. Do you know what will happen to your social media presence after you die? Well, I thought I'd just leave mine to fall into disuse over time. But it seems that we can be much more proactive about it because different platforms provide different procedures to either stay online or to disappear. It's actually a thing because current data indicates that there are about 5 billion social media users worldwide. And some of those accounts are lucrative for the users. Influencers, I'm looking at all of you. Will you still be able to make money from your presence, even if you are not here anymore? Keenan Forbes, the South African musician, also known as AKA, died unexpectedly in February 2023. He was shot to death along with his friend Tibello Motsoane. But AKA discussed the issue with his parents before he died. Ralph Benza was his brand strategist. Keenan's estate and executives, I suppose, decided to continue with social media activities on his accounts after his tragic death. Why did they decide to do that?
They wanted to continue the legacy, the presence of AKA. We do know the music continues because of streaming platforms, so everyone around the world can still consume the music and relay the music in the time that it was around. So they wanted to continue the visual element of it. And then also, plus, they wanted to be able to recognize special moments, for example, anniversaries of albums, on the day he passed, on his birthday, and any other accolades that he may still achieve. right. over the next few years.
So it's to maintain a connection, and it's almost like going to visit his grave and putting flowers on it.
Yes, yes, yes. Those people who really, really were inspired by him and loved his music.
So what were the initial reactions from his friends? Because, I mean, this is very new and kind of uncharted territory, isn't it?
We were shaking at first. The audience were as well. They probably say about, 20% were kind of confused. But the rest of them felt like, oh, my God, it feels like he's still there. It feels right. But over time, we've only probably get the awkward feeling only about probably 5% of the time or 5% of the comments or the engagement. And we feel like we're in the right direction. The narrative is a third party celebratory, announcing accolades and special moments.
So when you say third person and celebratory, so somebody can't go on there and post something apropos of whatever they want to post. They have to respond to something that is posted on there.
We don't respond because, that's something that signifies there's activities. But you can come there and pay your tribute. You can come there and talk about your memory and celebrate with us.
So did Kenan leave any specific instructions or wishes regarding the continuation of his social media presence after he was gone? I mean, he was a young man and he wasn't expecting to die. Or is this something that that came after he died?
He didn't leave instruction with us from the professional side of things, from his managers or his record label partner. But he did mention it to his mother. So his mother and his father is the executor of his estate. And through our conversation with them, they did mention that there was something that he actually talked about before, that he wanted to be present. He wanted to be present for forever. That's why he made the music, because he wanted the music to last for eternity. And so he also wanted his presence, his visuals and his communication with his fans and African alike to continue.
So is the plan for it to carry on for as long as possible, or is there a cutoff?
We don't have a plan to necessarily cut it off. Kind of a life of his own, because it's that platform you go and visit, in this new form of life. We will continue to do that. There's lessons we learn. So for the rest of the artists that we work with, it's something that we'll ask them to what we do, the uneventfulness of them passing on.
Even if we're not all celebrities, we all have social media platforms that we actually need to to make sure that it's tended to after we are not here anymore.
Yeah, probably just want an announcement and a memorial message, and then that would be it.
That's Rafael Benza, brand strategist. Now, we don't have to be famous or powerful to protect our digital legacy, bearing in mind that there are data and identity thieves out there who could misuse our socials should they gain access to it. So we brought in Philip Kisaka, an expert on all things copyright, digital legacy and digital law, to show us how we can protect our digital legacy. How are digital assets like social media accounts handled after someone dies?
Different companies handle these accounts differently. For instance, you look at Facebook. Facebook have what they call their legacy contact. Now, a legacy contact is someone appointed by an account user. And this appointment is to the effect that if I pass on, then this legacy contact will be able to do a number of things with my account. They'd be able to maybe change a profile and cover photos. They'd be able to pin tribute posts to a memorial page, or they even may move forward and request to remove the page. For Facebook, this appointment is made when the person is still alive, and this appointment is made on the Facebook platform. Whenever there is no legacy contact appointed, then a person who's either an executor or an administrator. Now, when I talk about executor or administrator, a different succession laws apply differently in different countries. The instance where there's a will, we say there's an executor to that will. And the will may then specify, I have this and this and that. And so is allowed or permitted to administer this social media account. And so in the event there is no legacy contact that was appointed when the account owner was alive, then you can use being an executor or an administrator where there was no will, you can send this or contact Facebook with this request. And then the profile will now become a memorial page.
If someone is considering creating a social media will, for want of a better term, where do they start?
Facebook will either let you appoint someone when you're still alive. So in the settings, you're able to say, this is my legacy contact. And there are already sort of things that a legacy contact can do and things that they can't do. So these are fixed by Facebook.
I didn't know it was there in your settings. That's really good to know.
Now, Facebook operates almost in a similar manner with Instagram because, of course, all of these are managed by Meta. And so just the way you can appoint a legacy contact for Facebook, then you can also do the same for Instagram. Now, with X, they do not allow you to either memorialize a page and they do not allow you to, you know, take over the page. So there are only two things you can do if you are the executor or the administrator in an estate of a deceased. And the first thing you can do is ask for X to delete this. Or number two, you can just let the account be. X does not delete accounts unless there's a formal request made to them by a kin or a family member of that individual to delete that account. However, X does not allow you to administer or to manage the account in the absence or when this individual has passed on.
If you were to approach X and want to delete the account of somebody who has passed on, do you need to, you know, give evidence as in a death certificate or something? And is it legally binding?
Of course, they'll be asking you for the death certificate. They'll be asking you for proof of your identification. And they'll also be asking for the deceased person's details. And because of the terms and conditions of these social media sites that we rarely read, we are sort of already agreeing to some of these things being done as they are done with regard to administration of these accounts when someone dies.
What about monetized social media accounts? Can they be passed on to beneficiaries after someone dies?
If it was set up in the name of an individual, if it was set up as an individual's account, then that would go heavily towards saying that when the individual passes on, then the way it has been prescribed for this data to be handled is how this data will be handled.
What do you suggest we all do right now in order to ensure that the data and our digital footprint is protected and respected when we are no longer alive?
If you want your account to subsist for platforms like Facebook, for platforms like Instagram, then you ought to appoint a legacy contact in that regard. For accounts like Google, so Google, you're able to access Gmail, you're able to access YouTube and all other associated services by Google, then you ought to also provide this contact to Google, a person who will be able to be granted access to this. In the absence of which, by default, these social media accounts have put privacy first to ensure that no one can access this account in your absence.
Philip Kisaka, digital privacy and protection lawyer. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
We're in the El Garbia region in Egypt to uncover the hidden side of a trade that feeds one of the richest, most exclusive industries in the world.
The documentary from the BBC World Service brings you award-winning journalism, unheard voices, amazing culture, and global issues.
We try to look at the bigger picture.
Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
So, I take it you've heard about hazardous waste, medical waste, and even radioactive waste. Those are all hazardous waste, by the way. But what about e-waste? What is it? Where does it come from? And how is it ending up on Ghanaian soil in monumental volumes? Not just Ghana, though, other countries as well. But those are some of the questions the well-known investigative journalist Anas Aremeyau, Anas, and photojournalist Muntaka Chasson and Benedict Curzon try to answer. The three were particularly interested in deepening the understanding around what happens to e-waste. They were also interested in challenging the dramatic imagery often used to portray Ghana as the dustbin of the world. And those are their quotes. Muntaka Chasson took the time to explain the complex ecosystem that provides a source of income for the thousands of people who recycle and repurpose e-waste. even as it has a very negative effect on the health of those people and the environment they work in. Let's talk about e-waste. What is it?
So it's an umbrella term for two main things in this context. One is what we call used electrical and electronic equipment, UEEE. The second one is waste electrical and electronic equipment, that is WEEE. The problem here is how usually by using e-waste, we conflate the two. So there's confusion. So normally when you say something is e-waste, people think of the waste. But e-waste can actually comprise that is used electrical equipment.
So e-waste is essentially electrical equipment that is discarded and piled up in landfill or what?
Yeah, but kind of that is how people define this. But technically, no. Like I said, it's an umbrella term. And yep. That's part of the confusion. So we have UEE, which is used, and then the waste.
Okay.
Right?
So tell us why that distinction matters and why e-waste is the thing that you concentrated your life on for the last 10 years.
That distinction is important because it defines what actually is waste at the point of export. For instance, there's a large market for used EEE in Ghana, that is functional e-waste.
So secondhand things, basically, or things that can be recycled.
No, actually, those that are functional.
Okay.
So,
repurposed, I mean, also.
Yeah, in a way. But when we talk about repurposing, I would like to rather focus on the second one.
Okay.
So the second one, which is the waste, those are non-repairable and non-reusable. But for many of the communities I've been documenting, they can still extract usable parts from this end of life. We call those end of life, those that are non-reusable and non-repairable.
Okay. So we're basically talking about electronic goods that are, in very many cases, exported from Western countries into countries like Ghana, and people find various ways of using them, reusing them, and disposing of them eventually. Tell me, where was the problem that you found and what did you find and how did you go about trying to establish these parameters?
On my part, I touched on the end-of-life e-waste paradox. And here, end-of-life is non-reusable and non-repairable equipment. So e-waste contains both hazardous and valuable materials. The body of work I present gives us insight into this binary. On the one hand, I highlight the hazardous nature of informal e-waste recycling, that is what you referred to earlier. And on the other hand, I show the secular economy potentials of the same sector. First, I show how e-waste work provides opportunities for upward social mobility. It reveals a complex process of rural-urban migration induced by the effect of climate change, where young people migrate from some of the most climate-impacted areas of Ghana to Accra to engage in hazardous e-waste work in order to achieve upward social mobility.
Okay.
And in the city, we show how extraction of materials from this end-of-life e-waste are exported out of Ghana. And that's what we call the reverse flow. And that's where analysis part begins.
Okay, so where does it go when it's exported out of Ghana?
After recovering the materials from where I ended up, analysis part discovered that a lot of these are being exported outside of Ghana, to places like the UK, to Hong Kong, to Italy, and many other countries where they extract precious metal from these materials. Here, the materials they extract actually locally generated end-of-life e-waste. They are not exactly imported from the West and go straight to informal recycling hubs. Okay, so whatever is first imported, and that's where Benedict comes, whatever is first imported first feeds into this large e-waste market in Ghana, that is functional e-waste market in Ghana, which are used by households, businesses. So it is after being used by households and businesses, sometimes after decades, before they end up in the informal recycling sector, where they now extract these valuable materials, which we reveal now that are collected and exported out of Ghana.
So in a way, people are looking for value. They're extracting value from these things.
Absolutely, yes. Not many people in Ghana can buy brand new iPhones and LG TVs and washing machines, so they rely on secondhand. But then something happened in January 2013, the government banned the import of some of these specific appliances, used ones, including laptop. That actually inspired ANASA's infiltration of Ghana's ports to show that this law actually doesn't work, and it's actually ridiculous.
It's not without hazard, right? Because there are poisonous ways in which this affects the environment and the people that work on it, because people are not necessarily protected properly when they're busy doing these extractions.
On the one hand, it provides them badly needed jobs, and on the other hand, the informal way they recycle e-waste exposes them to toxic bacteria.
So what's the solution that you're offering?
The formal recycling sectors get their source of materials from the informal sector. So there's the movement of materials from the informal sector to the formal sector and from there to the global economy. What this shows is that the government is not taking this sector seriously. But the companies who rely on this precious metal take this seriously. And that is why people like myself are urging and pushing for this sector to be taken seriously, because it has the capacity to become a significant source of precious metals. They are already a source of these materials collected and exported out of Ghana. Why wouldn't the Ghana government, touch on this? But over the years, for instance, the Ghana government has promised to construct e-waste recycling facilities to tackle some of this issue. They never did, until the demolition of the infamous Abogolochi scrapyard in July 2021, which has now rather worsened the pollution situation we are just talking about.
So what would you have said was the solution in that particular case? Because that Agbobloshi scrapyard, that was one of the big stories concerning how dangerous these sites and these goods can be to people that live around there and work on it.
Yeah, that is the problem, because the government refused to listen. They don't engage these informal communities. So one of the solutions is by demolishing this place, by erasing it, you think you do away with this problem? No. Now it has worsened. You know, in the past, we had just one Abogolochi. Now, after the demolition, now we have multiple types of Abogolochi. Imagine. That is because there's no more place for them to come together to recycle. There's no one place for NGOs and non-governmental organizations to engage them. And that was an oversight. And that's the government. The government did that. And that's one of the problems. They don't listen to anyone.
Now, I understand your irritation around the narrative that's been constructed, but the fact is that they are still dangerous materials, and people are not protected from working in those with those materials. Are you thinking that it should be regulated, because then it takes it away from the people who've been working with the material and benefiting from it in some way?
Absolutely. This is what they've been calling for. You know, they say regulators, supporters, tell us what to do. But the government has refused to do that because of the stories surrounding this, you know, this narrative, you know, the notion that there's these flows of e-waste from the global north straight from the port, seaport, to informal recycling areas, right? But that is not exactly what is happening. As Benedict Wetpool showed, she documented Ghanaian communities in the diaspora who export this used equipment to Ghana as a source of livelihood.
But surely, if some people benefit from it being a business in the north and ship wholesale large containers, you surely can't compare it with people, you know, individuals around different parts of in the diaspora sending. So it's a matter of scale.
No, actually, there's no one single evidence of mass containers. This is part of the narrative. Yeah, can you show me any evidence?
I haven't looked into it, but I know there were companies and some of them were forbidden by law to actually name. They were operating in Ivory Coast that did send huge quantities of waste material to West African countries.
Absolutely, perhaps that is Ivory Coast, but there's no one single evidence, right? For instance, consider the last decade of a container fooled by some companies in the West sending this waste to Ghana. That is not what is happening. A significant chunk of this used equipment are exported by the Ghanaians in the diaspora themselves. It's a big business in Ghana. That's because, like I explained to you, is the only way Ghanaians can get online. They can use washing machines, mobile phones, laptop.
So you're going to France and New York, or the exhibition is in a couple of months. What do you want people to take away from that?
I would like people to consider the complex and contradictory role that Iwes play. It's not black and white. And I also would like us collectively to think about the growing problem of e-waste, okay, which comes from overconsumption and also a lack of repair options. Of course, that is from the manufacturing side. And also the issue of global poverty. One, for instance, if you consider the context of places like Abu Ghoshi, that was demolished, right? A lot of foreign aid has gone into solving this problem, but nothing has happened. And the question always is, where did all this aid money to the world poor go? We've seen so much intervention from development organizations, but nothing has happened.
Okay.
So yeah.
So you want you want a rethink, and you want people to fundamentally consider how they live and how it affects other people.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you too.
That's the Ghanaian photojournalist Muntaka Chassant in Accra. Focus on Africa was created from the talents of Joseph Keane, Bella Hassan, Yvette Twagira-Maria and Nyasha Michelle here in London. Susan Kashui and Charles Kitonga made their contribution from Nairobi. Paul Bachibinga made it all fall into place as the senior journalist here in London. Nick Randell got us on air and online on time. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.
We're in the El Gharbia region in Egypt to uncover the hidden side of a trade that feeds one of the richest, most exclusive industries in the world.
The documentary from the BBC World Service brings you award-winning journalism, unheard voices, amazing culture, and global issues.
We try to look at the bigger picture.
Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.